the poll. If you do have interest in a particular subject or something like that, please fill out the poll as well with your own little hints, or contact Louise Zarco and I about any thoughts or comments you have. All sort of feedback, including unsolicited advice, is welcome. So first off, Brian will be telling us a little bit about preparing for detecting tau appearance.
And you need a mic if you want people online. Actually, use that.
All right.
Maybe I can get this a little closer to my mouth here. Okay, so I was asked to prepare a few slides to spark discussion. You'll notice that there's like 40 minutes or something allotted for this talk, and I'm not at all intending to take up all that 40 minutes, so I hope there will be some decent amount of discussion. So what I wanted to start off with, since I was asked to talk about what might we need experimentally to consider to start doing tau appearance physics and measurement, is first off, I want to just kind of frame the problem here. And I'll start off by saying identifying tau leptons at a few GeV is not simple. It's kind of a hard task. One of the things that we have to, fundamental things we have to keep in mind is that you have a threshold to produce a tau, and that threshold is, if you plug and chug the numbers here, is about 3.5 GeV. And so you want to definitely have a beam that's going to have a decent flux above 3.5 GeV. And what that means is that, for instance, if we were to make another narrowband beam, kind of like the Nova one, where you're centered on just, 2 GeV with almost no spread on that, that's a really optimally bad choice for trying to do this physics at the kind of baselines we're talking about. The LBNF beam, though, as it's currently designed, will in fact produce some taus, new taus, and interactions at the far detector. And this plot here, which I stole from a document that some folks at Brookhaven put together, shows you the flux as a function of energy here for either a NUMMI type design or an LBNF target type design. And what you can see is that you get some flux. It mostly turns on here around, 2-ish GeV. You have a decent amount of flux out to about 10, and you still have some stuff between 10 and 14. So you will produce new taus that have been oscillated. You can detect them in the detector at the relevant energies. But, you're not really going to get a whole lot of flux around about 14 GeV. The other side of that coin is not only how much flux do you have, what's your neutrino cross-section. So this plot here shows you the cross-section as a function of energy, and this is the cross-section over energy as a function of energy. And you see that it's turning on here between the threshold and about 20 GeV. It's still increasing a bit after that, above 20 GeV. And so if you take all this together, the production threshold and the flux, if you were to design an experiment to observe new tau appearance, you would want higher energies than are currently available in the LBNF or NUMMI design. LBNF is okay, but you might still want to go higher energies than that if you were to design something from scratch. The problem is, though, that as you get to higher and higher energies, you're going to have to go to longer and longer baselines in order to see the oscillations. And so, yeah.
F target, this is an optimized target design? Is a 2-meter type target? Does Laura know, perhaps? Yeah.
Yep, please.
So just to put those two plots together, which has been done, I can point you to the talks. We found that with NUMMI type horns, which I think is what's being used there, we can have something like 1,000 new taus at the far detector per year before any reconstruction efficiency. So
right.
That sort of sets the stage for what can be done with Dune. But All of the studies so far have been done with the Numi horns, which is no longer what we're planning to use for LBNF. So I have a student who is literally, as we speak, trying to figure out how much you could do with tau with the actual LBNF horns. But it's possible that if we wanted to do this, we want to make really sure that we maintain our ability to build Numi horns. And so I think the different, I can't quite see the legend there, but I think the different colors.
So it's fuzzy. This one's one, and I think this one is two. So the blue is 1 meter and the green is two. And there's not a whole lot of, you know, there's difference here, not a lot of difference towards the higher energy. You get more stuff down here at the low energy.
Yeah, so I think that was with a Numi-like fin target that studied various fin widths. And you want to go kind of low. You'd want to have like a 1.5 meter target, I think, slightly smaller than the nominal LBNF target. But the target doesn't matter too much, as you can see.
I guess, do you have any idea for the study that your student's doing, like the kind of improvements? I mean, is it like fractional, right? Is it like you did 1,000 events and you could get do both better with different things? Is it like 10% better? Is it double, right? I mean, even if you went from 1,000 to 2,000 taus before reconstruction, you know, I guess, do you have an idea? Like.
So that study is not really to try to improve. I mean, the horns that we're using now are optimized for low energy. I think, like, sort of my idea is to see if we could even get to 1,000 with these new horns. I mean, we have three of them now, so there are different combinations you could play with. Hold on, Jim. I think that's at 1.2 megawatts. So, yeah, I mean, probably the increases are going to come with power and not horns.
So the 1,000 events that you mentioned.
Hey, Jim, I think she wants you to hold the microphone.
Okay. Well, I was hoping my question was short and I wouldn't take a lot of time. So when you mentioned 1,000 events, was that with the Numi horns moved to the tau configuration? So it's not just that it's the Numi horns, it's the Numi horns with a optimization distance for tau. It's reconfigured.
It was with a very simple optimization. Like, we didn't run the full kind of optimization that we do for LBNF. It was just like moving horns by 10 centimeters and looking at the flux and then moving them some more.
Okay. So slide two did its job. On to slide three. Okay, what about the oscillation probability? I'm just going to keep things really simple and just assume a two-flavor oscillation scheme because it'll be close enough. So we can get a feel for what kind of constraints we have from the oscillations and the energy ranges we're talking about. So that's what you all know and love. We plug in, you know, you take basically the latest results from mass squared splitting, and they're somewhere around 2.5 to the minus 3 eV squared. And you assume maximal mixing just to make our lives easier. You end up with this oscillation probability as a function of the energy. And I indicate a few relevant places. So 4 GeV is about, if we flip back here, that's about where the peaks are in these fluxes for the beam. And then if you go up to about 8, that's where the shoulder kind of rolls off here. And so if I look between 4 and 8, your oscillation probabilities range somewhere between about a 0.75 to a 0.25 down here. And so, you know, you're not at your maximal oscillation, but it's not completely terrible. It's not the best you could do, but, you know, not terrible. So, you know, potentially you could look at a beam of that style and get to the physics that you want to, the precision measurements you want to do. And that was completely uncontroversial, I guess. Okay. So what about the... What?
I mean, it's the usual thing you can imagine I'm going to complain about. But I mean, how on earth are you going to figure out what the cross section is for a new tau when you're really close to the threshold for making them anyway, as opposed to at much higher energies where, you know,
no,
you make all kinds of other arguments?
I completely agree with you, Debbie. There are other things that have to go into this. This is just a statement of, you know, where are you seeing the oscillation at the beam lines that we have accessible to us.
Right. No, but you said, there's nothing controversial about this slide. And to me, I'm just offering that,
that's
something
because, that's because no one had said anything while I presented the slide.
Okay.
Also, just the point is that the cross-section also grows, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So although the probability is going down, the cross-section kind of compensates for that.
That's right.
But then the problem is the flux. So the fall is not that terrible, but still.
Right. It's not, you're not, for the beam, I believe this was, I put this in for the dune baseline.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the beam isn't, it's not like optimally bad, and
yeah,
it's not optimally good
yeah.
either. It's kind of right in the middle there. And then you'd really have to go through and do some careful studies to understand if all these effects we're talking about actually, you know, what direction they go in, and can you do the precision measurements that you're interested in doing with this kind of beam.
And I think a large part of that, just as I walk over to John, I could listen, is also going to be the backgrounds, though, as well, in that region as well,
right.
which is going to be a lot on the next slide. But you're going to have all those new mews populating and polluting that space, too.
So one thing, maybe it's a question more for Laura, but that I don't have a good feel for is, what do we know what the off-axis spectrum would look like for the LBNF, the optimized LBNF? You know, I mean, I can kind of imagine, you know, I know from NUMMI, I know what to expect. But the on-axis LBNF spectrum is so different that I don't have a good feel for what the off-axis would really look like. And I mean, of course, it depends on the angle, but I'm just wondering, like, if we looked off-axis, could we produce something that's above 3.5 above threshold, but still be a little bit more narrow?
John asked if we had those plots.
I don't think we've looked at off-axis since we went to the optimized beam. We looked at them a lot with the NUMMI style beam, and they go to lower energy, right? So it's never going to be a good idea for taus, I don't think. I would have to look at it for the optimized beam. With the fluxes that Brian showed on a previous slide, most of the events start at like 5 GeV because of the cross section. So you get most of your events between like 5 and 12 GeV. So I'm doubtful as to whether an off axis configuration of the standard LBNF beam is probably not going to work. Whether we go off axis in one of these alternate beams and do okay, that's an interesting question that hasn't been answered.
I do wonder about the power going that far off axis though as well, and if you're going to get enough to actually be able to do precision measurements with.
Pardon me for what is possibly an extremely naive question. But as difficult as it is detecting taus, because they often decay to look like mus or electrons or other things, having thought about this in a variety of contexts over years, it always seemed to me that the right way to do this was to have a neutrino beam slightly below the tau threshold and compare to one that's somewhat above the tau threshold. So that in one case you have the taus turned off, in the other case you have taus turned on. So that even if they look like muons, you can see a bump in the muon rate and thereby detect the tau interactions.
So for example, a narrow band beam that somehow straddled 3.5 GeV, on one side you'd be below threshold and above, you know. So if you look for the standard new mu disappearance signal, you would see something that looks very, very different than what we have seen in the past, right? And you could fit for that hypothesis. So it's not a direct, like, you know, it's not like you're looking for strictly new tau appearance in the sense of like, here's a, you know, an emulsion, you know, event with a clear tau, but, you know, statistically you would fit for it, just, you know, similar to what SuperK does.
I haven't thought about this much. So is the idea that you take the atmospheric delta squared as a given, and you just try to measure the mix, are we going to get from some sort of reconstructed energy like variable from these just above threshold events? Or we just, or is it just a rate measurement?
I don't think you want to do just a rate measurement. I think if you're going to do a precision measurement, you probably want, you want both, right? You want the rate and the shape.
So I would think so, but I don't know how the tau disappears. So you don't have a charged lepton. You have the tau decay products boosted. How well, I mean, what well, I does mean, an oscillation signature look
you're
like?
You're looking for the appearance, right? You said disappear, tau disappear.
The tau decays very quickly.
Right. Oh.
So you don't, I don't think we see that.
That's
okay,
right.
We're going to do emulsion. Fine. I thought we were talking about liquid argon.
No, we're not. We're not. So how about I go to my next slide?
Okay. Yeah. So maybe that's the question. So if you can't see the actual tau ionization or whatever signature,
right,
how well can you do? And if you can, how well can you do? Maybe is the question.
Right. So how about I go through my next slide? So how do you detect the tau? Well, there have been two detectors so far that have done this, Donut and Opera. There's Donut, which has a finding donut images this far removed from when it ran was a bit of a challenge, and also a bit amusing too, because their web page is so early 1990s that it was, you know, it's maybe worth a nostalgic look at what's going, what they have there. Anyway, so both of these detectors, Donut and then the Nopra down here, were based on emulsion plate detection. And they're a really good choice for excellent spatial resolution, because remember, the distance the tau lepton travels before it decays is 87 microns. So, you know, it's not, as you were saying, Matt, it's not very far. It's hard to see. Now, with Donut, they were looking at 100 GeV neutrinos, and so they were boosted up to a couple of millimeters. And that was much easier to see. It was kind of impressive to look at some of their event displays. But of course, the trick is that when you want to do a neutrino oscillation experiment over a long baseline, you need a lot of mass for the neutrinos to interact with. And so, and then you want to pack these emulsion plates between the massive elements. And so the way Opera did this was that they interleaved 56 1 millimeter thick lead plates with the emulsion plates to form a single brick. And then when you added up the mass of all those bricks, they got about 1.2 kilotons in total mass for the active detector. Keeping in mind that at the Dune baseline, we're talking about, you know, a detector on the order of 40 kilotons. I don't think you're going to really want to be packing emulsion plates to make up that kind of mass. The other issue with emulsion plates is that processing the data to find the leptons is a whole lot of work. There were, in the initial days of Opera, they had people hand scanning these. I think they eventually got it a bit more automated, but it's still a lot of effort to pull the plates off send them to some place to be processed and then actually find the event. So, you know, it'd be really great as long as we're just thinking of what to do here and not constraining ourselves by what's necessarily really practical at this moment. It'd be great to have a digital revolution that with emulsion plate technology that's kind of analogous to the bubble chambers and revolution with liquid argon TPCs, and that you get the same kind of resolution, but you have a much better automated way to digitize and reconstruct things. Now that brings up a question, why not just use the liquid argon TPC that we're going to have, you know, the 40 kilotons eventually at the South Dakota site? Well, that's certainly an option. To really identify the taus though, you know, your resolution is gonna be determined by the timing in the drift direction and your wire pitch. And it gets really hard if you're using wires, that is. Maybe you want to use something else like a pixelated detector. But it does get hard to pack the wires that close together and still have the planes be transparent if you're going to do a traditional style liquid argon TPC. And the other thing that you have to worry about, which I should thank Joseph for pointing out to me because I'd forgotten it, you don't want to forget about the diffusion of the drifting electrons either. If you're talking about a decay length of 87 microns, you know, any amount of diffusion is going to really mess with you as you're trying to reconstruct that tau track. I'll pause for any comments. Yeah.
But how important is it that we actually detect the tau?
That's a great question. I've got a question along those lines on my last slide that's after this one, if we want to wait.
Sure, let's wait.
So anyway, just to give you a sense of what you're looking for, this is the first candidate from Opera, and I drew this by hand, so to speak, the circle here, according to this legend here. So it's about a 300 micron radius of that circle, and so your tau is this little bit here that's about 150 microns. And their beam energy, their average energy was 17 GeV. So that just kind of gives you a sense of what you're looking for at around these energies. Okay, so here's the slide where I just put up a bunch of questions and don't try to answer any of them, and I hope to have more discussion. One thing we should think about is, can we do this experiment with the current accelerator technology? Is the LBNF beam what we want to use? Do we want to optimize? Do we want to think about looking at ways to make a more intense beam? Would it be smart for us to start thinking about, should we produce a more intense beam that also means that we can get to higher energies and longer baselines and maybe be a stepping stone for a better beam eventually for the energy frontier? That's one question that we can ponder here. What about the beam energy? The LBNF beam, as we saw, we could use that. We wouldn't have as clear of a signal given the interplay of the thresholds and the cross sections and the oscillation probability as if you optimized your experiment to sit right at the oscillation maximum and the tau production, and where you have sufficient, you're above the production threshold and you have sufficient cross section. Of course, if you want to make a high energy beam, that demands much higher fluxes because you have to combat the 1 over r squared reduction in flux with the baseline. And so that's one set of things to think about. As Laura mentioned, Dune would have about 800 new tau interactions from the beam in the 40 kilotons for 10 to the 21 TOTs. That's still the right number? Laura's shaking her head, yes. Okay. That's not insubstantial. Maybe we could look at adding another detector at SURF, and in which case, what might we pursue? You'd want to have really good resolution on a scale of microns. You'd prefer some kind of automated readout, and that kind of resolution automated readout, you might naturally think about doing something with silicon, but of course you also need a lot of mass, so that's not so helpful if you want to use silicon. And Laura now wants to complain or comment on something I've said.
Yeah, I just want everyone to understand that Dune, like in its current configuration, will not have 800 new tau interactions. I think it's something like 100 maybe at the most. But if we change the beamline configuration dramatically, we could get about that.
Okay.
So that 800 is dependent on optimizing the beam for doing specifically tau appearance. Okay, she nodded her head, yes.
Okay.
One more question.
So the idea for Dune would be to do that after the end of the CP run. When we finish that, then we would reconfigure the beam to give that. But I have two questions. Perhaps Laura knows the answer. I understand there is some effort within Dune to try to reconstruct new taus. And I thought they were trying to get efficiency
right.
for reconstruction. So
that's something I was going to say in my last point here, but I'll say it now. It goes along with what I think John was asking. Do you actually need to see the new tau? And I think what they're working on in Dune is something analogous to what Minos did when it was looking for the new electron neutrino appearance, in that you can train a neural net or a CVN or some kind of multivariate analysis to try to pick these things out, but you're going to do it in a very statistical way, and it's hard to make a really precision measurement when you're doing that, I think.
Okay, thank you, Brian.
Yeah.
The second question is, since we have already determined that these 800 new taus are for the reconfigured LBNF dune, I'm wondering, Laura, why the student is trying to put the new horns, the optimized horns. I thought the old horns were better for new tau production.
So Laura, we could just change places if you want. That's fine.
So I think it's an open question what we can do with new tau with the optimized LBNF horn. So that's what he's trying to answer, is just trying to understand what we can do with those horns.
So Vaia made the comment, so that Joseph doesn't have to run back and forth, that so far the old ones were better. And I think Laura sort of hand waved and said, we don't know.
Yeah, so I guess just to kind of repeat what I said earlier, I think this is, you know, looking for a muon-like signal in the final state, I think it's different than looking for new appearance in Minos, right? Where you're actually looking for an electron, an EM shower, right? Here you'd just be looking for a muon. And so things would look, you know, you're not trying to say that these are clearly new tau events. It's just an excess of new of events with a
muon
observed muon in the final state, where, you know, but a lot of those would be coming from tau, which we could probably predict reasonably well at first, you know, when we first get started.
There would be a significant amount of smearing, though, due to the energy loss. I think coming back to Matt's question about of the tau lepton itself, because you would only see the muon, you wouldn't see sort of where the tau itself was going before it decayed into the muon to try and work back what the energy loss to the neutrino was and the tau decays. Well, yeah, but if you're able to resolve it, couldn't you try to do some missing ET analysis of it?
So it's the guy who clearly got his thesis on a collider experiment.
Sorry.
So I don't think this is the purpose of the talk, but I sort of missed the point of why we want to measure new taus. I mean, it's cool. I like more signals in the detector, but it's already been seen by Donut. It's been seen by Super K, Opera. We want to actually do an oscillation appearance measurement with new taus, and that's a step beyond can we see new taus, how many taus do we get, and so that's, I think,
right. So, sure.
Sure, but if you get some, doesn't mean you can. You're right. You have to make sure you have at least one, I guess. Maybe not. I don't know.
Right. That's right. It's not a precision measurement.
Yes, I think this kind of goes back to various points that you can, you know, like John was saying, you can look for a difference in rate in what you expect. But if the community cannot say that that is due to taus categorically, just that it's consistent with what you expect, you know, are people going to be happy with that, or would you want something more definitive?
Yeah, you know, I think it really comes down to, how precise do you want to make your measurement, and what's your ultimate goal there? Are you trying to do a unitarity triangle measurement, or are you just trying to say that we definitely see taus appearing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is definitely something that, you know, I think the next talk will 100% get to that, right? And then, like, hopefully that will lead this conversation, you know, and are we just trying to prove with higher statistics that the previous tau appearance results are correct and consistent with what we expect, or are we trying to...
I'll make a longer comment eventually, but I mean, I think we know that new moons are going to new taus, and you know that new taus can create taus, right? I think this is fine. We don't need to prove that again and again. But I think it's very important to measure that. I'll show in slides soon. But I actually have a question, which is Super K with atmospheric neutrinos can do some sort of statistical measurement of new taus, right?
Right.
What is the equivalent for Dune? Do we have any study? Probably we don't have any study on that.
Well, there have been some folks who are trying to study this. I know that Alberto has been working with a student here to do that, and Ting Jun too, I believe. And I think there's another group somewhere else who is also looking at it, but who's doing it escapes me right now.
Right now, like Super K has something like 130 tau events, tau candidate events or something like that. So it's not huge, right? It's not a huge data set.
That's right. And it's, you know, it's trying to throw things into a multivariate analysis and pull out some kind of signal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I think having the information, you know, from the theory community again with what precision you would need in order to be able to answer some question, right? Like, you know, like what the question is like, you know, so I think that'd be a very useful input, right? Is it good to have a 20%, we're pretty sure we saw tells, or do we want the 1% unitarity?
Jen, our motivation for doing so may push us in different ways. So it's one thing to say we're building Dune. How can we leverage our existing beamline and detector to try to say as much as we can about oscillations to new taus versus we want to constrain this mixing matrix element to this precision, which is probably the same precision as you get by applying unitarity in the absence of new tau, to have comparable sort of precision. And to do that, we need to build a new experiment that's optimized for a baseline and a thing, because we're thinking post 2026, and obviously,
right,
Dune will run through 2026. But if we're gonna start planning another big experiment specifically to go after, if the case is there to go after new tau appearance at the precision level, then it's different than
it's not too early to start thinking about it. Is the point, which is why I think we're having these meetings.
Does anybody else want to comment?
Well, I would say that at least from the LBNF Dune point of view, the instructions we got on the LBNF side from the Dune spokespeople so far was that we should move ahead with the current plans we have, and whatever other physics we need to do, like new taus, etc., whatever will come later, because we were planning to do it after the end of the run, will have to be accommodated within our current needs. So that is what we are trying to do, and we have been trying to do for the past couple of years, to see with the current beam line we have, how could we maximize new taus, and can we reconstruct them or not. Clearly, it is another thing to go and build a dedicated experiment, but that is the framework within which we are trying to design the LBNF beamline now. I mean, allow flexibility for this to happen, but we are not trying to tune all the parameters for this to happen.
Right. I think there's a lot of parameter space that's available out there, yeah, between design everything completely new to use what we're already going to have and get more clever about how to make the measurement.
I don't know how well I'm matching the scope of these meetings, but I'm thinking towards the next snowmass. At the next snowmass, maybe I'm wrong, but in the paradigm of trying to get the most out of what we're already planning to do, that seems to be pre the next snowmass. The next snowmass would be the time to put visionary things forward that either extend Dune in a major way or go beyond Dune or run in parallel with Dune, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm done. So, that's it.
So were there any comments online as well? Because we didn't hear anybody on the phone. All right. Thank you. And again, if you have comments, thoughts, or anything like that that you want to filter into sort of the broader discussion, sending us an email or filling out the polls that we send around with that sort of information would be helpful. Next up, we have a talk on the more theoretical side of all of this. Possibly, probably would have been good to start with that one, but and there you go. So, and okay, anyway, I'll let you talk.
All right. Okay. So yeah, I also don't have many slides. So, I guess we can discuss and see what happens. So the only thing that I want to say here is, why do you care about precision neutrino physics in general? But I'll focus on new taus. just to put us in like some same page here, we don't know so much actually about the PMNS matrix. We know a lot if we take into account unitarity, if we assume that the standard model is correct and that the standard Trino-Trino picture is fine. But that's an assumption, right? That's it's reasonable. It's a quite reasonable assumption, but it's still an assumption. So we know these guys from Solar Neutrino and Kamlan, assuming unitarity. We know this the sum of the square of all these guys from the neutral current measurement of snow. This guy here comes from reactor neutrinos, accelerator neutrinos in the moon disappearance mode. Then appearance mode is the combination there. And if you look at this whole thing here, well, the unknowns that we still have there is the octant of theta 2-3, mass order in delta CP, we all know that. But the point is that we have almost no information on the tau rho. So to make this point a little bit more clear, this is actually funny because Stephen wanted me to give the last talk, and I'm going to show his paper in this one. But there is a nice paper by Stephen and Mark where they essentially they didn't do a global fit, but they globally looked at what is happening with the PMNS matrix, the determination of PMNS matrix, assuming unitarity and without assuming unitarity, right? So this without assuming unitarity is a bit more model independent. And you see here, for instance, for these entries, let me first just show you exactly what that means. So when you have a neutrino experiment, we all know that the oscillation formula goes like U, let's say, mu I U EI if it's appearance times the phases. So if you just do that without assuming unitarity, you can measure these three guys here without unitarity by combining reactor neutrinos, short baseline, reactor long baseline, that's Kamlan, and solar neutrinos. So you see you have three experiments, three classes of experiments, and three entries, so you expect to measure them quite well. For the muon line, you have muon disappearance and muon appearance and mu to nui. And now you see that you have two for three, so you already expect that one is not going to be very well measured. And actually, if you think, it's quite difficult to see the muon oscillation in solar distance, right? We don't have any experiment on that. And the last one for the power, we have Supercan Opera. You know, Opera had what, five events, maybe six, I don't remember. And SuperK, it's this analysis that we just discussed, right? That they don't see the new tau itself, right? It's just some probabilistic classification of events. So if we look this a bit more, you know, in detail, you see that these entries here, they actually are pretty well measured with or without unitarity, right? So solar neutrinos here, there is a 10% spread without unitarity, few percent here, 10% over there. But then when you look at all these guys, there's a huge spread. And if you focus on the tau line, you have here, for instance, look at this one. With unitarity, there's almost, you know, 15% spread. Without unitarity, it couldn't be worse than that, right? Well, it could, but it's a lot, right? Like from 0.4 to 0.8. So this is the first point that in my opinion, I think it's important that, if we don't assume unitarity, we actually don't know the PMNS matrix. This is like the most basic thing, right? Let me give you a few more motivations for doing this precision physics, and then we can discuss a bit. Another motivation, for instance, is this I took from the new fit webpage. So this global fit, taking into account essentially all experiments available. And what they're doing here is that they're trying to do the equivalent of what people do for the quark sector to close the CKM matrix. Here they're trying to close these PMNS triangles. And you see here, for instance, for the fit with normal hierarchy, I don't know if you can read, but this segment here is U mu 1, U mu 3. So that's fairly well known. This I cannot read. UE1, UE3. So this is actually pretty well known, but then you have this one, which has tau 1 and tau 3. So essentially, if you think that you fix these two segments, you can actually rotate this guy and just adjust the size of this thing here, and you get almost a complete circle, right? So that tells you that we have almost no idea of what what is this thing here? So we really don't know if the unitarity triangles in the neutrino case, they close or not. We still don't know that. And the last point, I think this is the last point, maybe there's one point after that, is that if you think about a well-defined BSM model, for instance, sterile neutrinos, if we look at what happens with the mixing of the sterile neutrinos with electrons, for instance, just look at the act. I mean, the details are not very important, just that given the author list, the paper is definitely correct, and this is a good paper, but the details are not important, just believe me. This axis here is in log scale, right? This axis here for the mu mixing is also in log scale. So you're like probing at the percent level or so. But then we go to the tau, and although the mu is in log scale, the tau entry is in linear scale, right? Essentially because we don't know much about taus. We don't know much about tau neutrinos. So the measurement here comes from atmospheric neutrinos, from Super K, Deep Core, and Ice Cube. But essentially, we don't have a measurement of this guy here using a direct observation of new taus, right, or something like that. And you see that the bound, even assuming a specific model, the bound is about, I don't know, maybe 15, 17% on this U tau 4 squared. So that's pretty bad. I had another point. So the other point that I want to make is that if you think about BSM, the third family in general, not only for neutrinos, the third family is very poorly known, right? Top quarks are tough. Taus are very tough. Bs are fine. Bs are not so difficult, but that's the only part in the third family that is not incredibly difficult. And we have tau neutrinos. And for instance, if you just take a model that depends on the flavor, for instance, here we gauge the B minus L of the third family just to prove a point. If you look at that, what happens is that, so this is like the parameter space for the new gauge boson. This is the mass and this is the coupling. And here we took into account like, I don't know, 25 or 30 bounds. You know, we did the whole model, like all the scalar sector and all that, just to make sure that we are not missing anything. And you see that the first thing I want to say is that this new gauge boson could be about 1 GeV with a gauge coupling of 2 10 to the minus 2. And that's very scary to think that we could have a 1 GeV guy just hiding the third family and we wouldn't know about that. And the other thing is that this red region here, excluded region, is actually from neutrino physics. This comes from atmospheric neutrinos, essentially the determination of this epsilon tau tau in NSIs, but this comes from a matter effect in atmospheric neutrinos, right? So if you have something happen with tau neutrinos, since atmospheric neutrinos have a very long baseline, you have large matter effect, and then you enhance this kind of effect. But the point is that neutrinos here are playing a role that could be stronger or as competitive as, for instance, D physics, atomic parity violation, upsilon decays, and so on. So this is actually quite impressive for me, because you would expect that neutrinos could never compete with these guys, right? And one of the main points here is that we do have a lot of new taus in the far detector. Not saying that they're easy, but we do have lots of them. So related to the question that we were discussing before, what precision we want to achieve, this is a very tricky question. I personally don't like this question at all, but I will give you some numbers eventually. So as a rule of thumb, the better, right? Like the better we measure, the better we know what we are measuring. But we need to remember that NOVA and T2K, they're actually the first experiments to really scratch the trino-trino paradigm, right? Like if you look, Minos had some Numu Chunui results in the final run, so that is important. But still, if you don't take that into account, all other experiments, we could probably fit them with a trino-trino framework, right? Numu to Numu, we can do with a trino-trino framework. Nui to Nui also. So the first one to really give you something new, which touches the trino-trino paradigm, which is, you know, it's sensitive to the hierarchy, it's sensitive to delta CP, is NOVA and T2K. So we just touched that, right? So it's extremely important to test it, because we don't know almost anything about the three neutrino particles. Barely measuring the power. So if I just go back here, as the first answer to the question, which precision we want to get, anything better than 40% already proves something, right? So that's the friendly answer. But now, I want to remind you guys about two things that I don't know if this is fortunately or unfortunately, but flavor physics is extremely hard, right? Let's forget about neutrinos for a moment. Let's go for quarks. We have measured the CKM very, very well. What did we learn with that? It's not obvious, right? We learned many things, but like which models can we just rule them out and et cetera? It is very tricky. The flavor puzzle is probably one of the most difficult of the standard model. And on top of that, you guys are doing neutrino experiments, which are not the easiest ones in the planet, right? So we got, a huge difficulty in the theory side and a huge difficulty in the experimental side. That's good. That's good because it gives us jobs for a long time. But if you just go back to the question, what is the precision we want to achieve? Let's just, change this question for other areas, right? If you look at LHC, how high in energy should the LHC do? Should we stop at 14 TeV and be done with that? Should we talk about 100 TeV? If we could go to 1,000 TeV, don't you think people would be trying to do that? So this is why I don't like this kind of question, right? I mean, for me, it sounds like when should we retire or when should we stop doing physics? And I don't think we should. I think we need to understand things and we need to understand them as better as we can. For instance, how precise do we want to measure G minus two of the muon? As precise as we can, right? As allowed. And so on. So I think the point is that, in my view, the motivation to measure tau neutrinos is essentially because we don't know almost nothing about them. So if the unknowns are at the order of 40% in a matrix that goes from 0 to 1, I think it's a big deal, right? So we basically don't know anything. We should do something about that. So I think to answer your question, like what you said, what do we want to do? I think we don't need to say that we are rediscovering the tau neutrino. I think we already know that tau neutrino is there and it moves, goes to taus, and new taus generate taus. But besides that, we don't know much more, right? So I think it's of course, if you assume three neutrinos, doing the tau measurement is not going to help you much on getting, let's say, delta M square atmospheric, right? These tau neutrinos are not going to help on that. It's not going to help you on determining theta 2, 3 very much. But it's going to help you on saying that there is a three neutrino paradigm that it comes from a unitary matrix and so on, right? So it actually tests the entire model. So I don't have anything else. So I would like to hear your opinion on that.
I was just going to say, but if you're going to spend money, you have to do better than Super K.
Yes, definitely.
As an
definitely.
Example of a yeah. real world constraint.
Yeah.
So, or maybe if Hyper K gets so Dune will get built. So you have to do, if you're going to do something new, it has to be yeah. beyond what you can get from Super K, Dune, with
I
atmospheric
agree.
Neutrinos, and maybe Hyper K if that comes
I fully agree.
I guess just to add to that, if we're spending not only money, but a considerable amount of money for any idea that we've possibly even vaguely considered to build a tau neutrino detector. I mean, you have to also have a statement that money is best spent if there is a competition for additional future things that will happen beyond June. There has to be, again, a statement that tau neutrinos is where we want to put our large amount of potential money compared to other possible, things from the other frontiers, which could also compete. So it's not even a question of it being interesting. It's a question of, I don't think anyone's doubting that it is. It's a question of, it's sort of some payoff between how expensive compared to how much physics.
So I am way not an expert in the subject. What I'm about to say is about all I know about it. But my understanding is that one consequence of non-unitarity could be instantaneous transitions of neutrinos.
For instance, yes.
And so experimentally, the challenge there is understanding the neutrino flux exquisitely well. And it's not clear how well we could do there, but it's clear we could probably do better than we do now. So how would that sort of measure, is that sort of measurement complementary to the tau neutrino?
Yeah, definitely.
Is that something that we should consider pursuing?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think there are so many studies regarding the unitarity and tau neutrinos in DUNE. But that's definitely something we should do. We should discuss a bit more about that. For instance, if of course this is a bit model dependent, but if you think about the sterile case, this I think we did for a 1 EV square sterile. So 1 EV square sterile is let's see, 1 EV, you get it's starting to oscillate a little bit at the near detector. But it's already completely flattened out at the far detector, right? So at the far detector, you essentially see an overall transition from NUMUS to NUTAUS, for instance. So you could have that. You could have this kind of effect. So this, for instance, if you have a heavier, let's say 1 EV square sterile, if you go to the far detector of DUNE, even where you don't have the standard probability, you could still have some of the non-standard probability, right? For instance, induced by sterile. So say the idea is essentially that new moves would oscillate to new S, and new S would oscillate to new taus. And that doesn't have the same delta M squared, doesn't have exactly the same pattern. So
sort of riff off of the previous question then, with an exquisitely well-known neutrino beam, I guess generally we're talking about neutrino factories. So then maybe an additional question onto that is, do we gain a lot of information as well from looking for new E's to be oscillating into new taus? If we would have a neutrino factory beam, we could imagine having both a well-known new E and new mu flux.
Yeah. So of course, everything depends a bit on what is the underlying framework you have. But let's just take three neutrinos. If you do new E to new tau, So let's look at new mu to new E, right? So nu mu to nu e is sensitive to the entries of ei mu I. So essentially, it's this combination here and then the product of these guys here. If you do e to tau, it doesn't matter if it's e to tau or tau to e. I mean, there is a CT phase, but apart from that, you get like the product of these guys and these guys here. The advantage there is that these things here you know pretty well, while these ones you don't. So if you do nu mu to nu tau, there is still some uncertainty here. On this just substitute the E by a tau here, there's some uncertainty on this factor, which is not negligible. But yeah, no, doing nu E to nu tau would be also pretty good. But I think this is a bit more complicated. Because even in a new neutrino factor, you have mostly nu mu's, right? But the nu E's are lower energy, right? So
no, they're the same. They're higher.
Oh, I see.
The response was the energy of the new E's tends to be a little bit higher, and you get one new E for every new mu, just from the boosted muon.
Yeah, I mean, having a neutrino factor would be awesome. I don't know how feasible that is, but.
Well, I mean, it's coming back. Just coming back to the question of, you know, if we had a beam that was highly precise, so we could do instantaneous neutrino transitions, then what else would we be able to leverage that same beam line for? And to say that we could over-constrain the new mu oscillation parameters to actually produce a high precision measurement of two elements of the M&S matrix is an interesting additional thing that you gain.
Yeah.
But isn't the case for the neutrino, if there are more neutrinos, then the only way to unravel this is with this type of beam where you know everything very well and you have new E's and new mu's.
Depends a bit on their masses, right? So for instance, if you have EV steriles, you could think that the short baseline program could help you on that. Of course, that if they only mix with tau neutrinos, then it's very, very difficult. But for instance, I didn't include here, I don't know how to, I can draw.
Yeah, you could draw.
Somewhere.
What about neutral current disappearance? Because this came up.
Current disappearance, if you look here, where's that? So here, for instance, this bound here is minus, minus plus, and nova neutral current disappearance. There is also the CC analysis also folded in, but the neutral current is there, right? So it does give you some knowledge there.
Yeah, but that's long baseline.
That's long, yeah. But you could imagine that, for instance, depending on how you oscillate, in some regions you could get more oscillation the near detector than the far detector. So if you think that the far detector things that have averaged out, and the near detector could have some shape, actually your far detector starts playing the role of setting the normalization, right?
I mean, so, that Minos measurement is a near detector, far detector,
yeah.
Point neutral current disappearance measurement.
So it's a combination of both. I mean, in the case of Minos, for instance, you get this sensitivity to a large range of delta M squared, right? When oscillations happen more at the far detector or at more at the near detector and so on. So the thing that I wanted to draw, if I still have a few minutes, is
you built lots of contingency for discussion into the schedule, so we're not in any.
So the thing I want to draw is just this, that go back to that point about which experiment is the best to probe for new neutrinos. For instance, if you think that these new neutrinos are heavier, not infinitely heavy, but this would be the U tau 4 entry square, and this would be the mass of this heavy neutrino. Let's make 1 GeV here. Here about, 100 GeV, and here 10 MeV. This, take it with a grain of salt, all right, because I'm drawing. You have some region there, which comes from Charm 2, I think. I'm not entirely sure. I would need to check, but I think it's Charm 2. And here have some region for Delphi. And essentially, this point here, the Mixon square is 0.1-ish. And here is about 10 to minus 3. This plateau would be about 10 to minus 4. So you do have some region here where if you have a neutrino that is about the GeV, so around the tau mass, the mixing square could actually be pretty large, right? Mixing square could be like order 10 to 1 to 10%. And in this case, it's a bit more complicated to talk about oscillations because these guys are so heavy that they decouple from the wave packet. So looking at oscillations might not be the best way. For instance, you could want to look at new taus coming, interacting with whatever you have there, your liquid argon, giving you some hadronic blob, and then generating one of these heavy guys. And then these heavy guys, depending on the mass and the boost, they could fly a bit and then decay. For instance, one decay mode would be a lepton and a pi plus. Well, a pi whatever, right? Lepton plus pi minus, for instance. So you could have this kind of decay, which could give you a second blob. So you could have like a double bang signature, right? So there is a first interaction of new tau. It generates this heavy guy, which could fly a few millimeters on your detector and then decay again. Or you could just try to look at, for instance, a possible decay mode here would be to 3 leptons. If this guy has a non-zero mixing with muons, with mu neutrinos, you could have mu, mu, mu here, right? So you could have, for instance, mu plus mu minus or e plus e minus and so on. So the way you look for these guys depends a bit on their masses and the model, the underlying model. But I think the advantage of liquid argon is that you can look for a lot of stuff, right? You can distinguish one electrons from two electrons. You can distinguish muons from pions, gammas from e's. So
I think the neutrino factory is a possible argument I buy for why we should build a accelerator-based experiment to look for new tau appearance, because you can constrain so many, you can make a whole program out of it.
Yeah.
And of course I buy pushing Dune as far as it can go to say something about taus. But short of those two, so going all out for the neutrino factory or just eking out what you have, I don't really see a motivation for another accelerator-based new tau appearance experiment coming into focus for me. I think you could go the other way and say, what could we learn from atmospheric neutrinos and build a multi-purpose observatory, you know, like a hypercat, you know, you could dream in that direction, but I don't really see, is that right? Does everyone agree with those two statements that, you know, you either, because I don't really see where else you go.
That's a good question.
I guess part of the point would be is if they've built Hyper-K, what would we build that wasn't already just Hyper-K? And Super-K has seen about 100 events, and it took them a long time. I'm not sure how much POT that actually is for the Super-K running to get to that 100 events. Even with Hyper-K, maybe you're only getting to 1,000 events. I don't know how much bigger you're getting, right? Like, how large Hyper-K will eventually be. But again, like, is that you're still on your 1,000 of TAUs? Is 1,000 of TAUs again enough events?
So there's this plan to possibly put a detector in Korea to go with Hyper-K, right? Which is a long baseline, so it must be good for TAUs. I don't know. We can propose. It doesn't have to be stuff at Fermilab. We could say that. I don't know if that's good for TAUs. I haven't seen any plots.
But the problem there is that the beam is lower energy, right? So it's narrow band and lower energy, so you're never going to produce the TAU. But
we can make them put in a new beam.
I mean, I think your question is the crux of it, right? Like, can you actually do something in between an Adreno factory and, let's say, Dune? And what is that? I don't know. That's a very good question.
You know, prototype TAU detector in the Dune beam line, which does the R&D for a future neutrino factory. I don't know. You can think of leveraging both of them.
Also, another thing that at least I tend to think is that the way we are now, at least for liquid argon, is that these detectors, they are sort of multi-purpose, right? So it's something that the community still have not explored fully, but there are lots of new physics that we can do with liquid argon. It's new physics connected to neutrinos. For instance, this kind of double bank signatures is something that I would imagine is much easier to do in a liquid argon detector, depending on what is your specific signature for some specific signatures than in water sharing cost, right? Just because of the precision you have on vertexing and the precision you have to reconstruct different particles, like one electron or two electrons and so on. So I think if you want to do new TAUs, since it's difficult to get competitive with the new MU measurements, you might also want to push for new physics.
Seems to have run out of comments. Unless there's anything. So the next topic talk that we have was a talk request that we received, and it's slightly off the topic of how. So we're going to move away from that. So unless anyone has anything additionally they want to add, please continue to fill out if you have additional feedback or things that you think we should talk about. You can use the Google form to generally send us information, or obviously just email us. I do have your slides up, but they may look weird because I don't have PowerPoint. So you may want to use your own laptop to have it. Yeah, well, so I have them open, but they will probably look a little. You may look a little funky.
Okay, I have requested kind of 10 minutes to make a plea, and I guess I'm old enough so I can do that. We always talk about accelerators and detectors and separately, and I believe as Bob Zaska said, that this might be the Dune might be last neutrino experiment built. I believe we should really think very carefully before we box ourselves in something that will be hard to change 10 years from now, once when it is built. And that's the reason why I said, this statement, think globally, act locally, works both ways. I mean, you can think locally and act globally. And can I use this? Okay, so what I'm trying to say, we as a communities should reach and try to talk more with each other than just be neutrino physics community or accelerator physics or stuff like this. About 2 years, and I'll give this as an example. I'm not pushing back the idea which I understood 2 years ago was rejected by Dune management. I'm just using this as an example what might be somehow useful to keep in mind when we are doing final design of the Dune and building Dune, especially beamline. And if somebody is interested, I can give you the document. I never finish it, but I can give it. Okay, the idea was very simple. At that time, there were different motivation for this. Initially, I started with the idea, can I save the money? Then more, it looked to me that decay pipe is too short, and the reason is too short because the dump is all the way down. So idea was very simple. The idea was, is there any way to combine dune on axis and off axis experiment, and with very simple modification, and it's not even modification. I use three horns as it is nominal dune design, and put two bending magnets between two. It would be really nice if I can somehow point. But where I'm pressing? I see, okay. So, this is horn one, this is horn two, this is horn three. This is the beginning of the decay pipe. So, I had slightly to separate two horns to put the dipole. Simple C dipole, pulse magnet, and the second one. And concept was trivial. Let's not to send all the junk down the decay pipe. Send only the particle which are of interest for experiment. So basically what I'm doing, I'm tuning these two magnets to particular energy to collect only pions of particular energy for which the neutrino experiments will be interesting. And at that time, basically, I did two options. One is where I had a proton beam directly straight and pion beam bended toward the detectors for 5.7 degrees, and second option was in between, both beams were bent. I could not make broadband beam as dune people are having, and dotted line represent the neutrinos in far detector, as a function of energy. And solid lines are neutrinos basically produce when there is a selection of the pi and b energy. And at that time, I choose, I believe, four Jevons pi. But what was really, so I'm failing to have a broad beam as nominal Dune design is, but where I'm gaining very much, I have much less background. And I have full sign selection of the particles. And when I change the sign to be half of between, I got even broader beam, but never really fully recovered nominal. So why I thought this was interesting, because young people are talking about CP violation, and I can do much better in CP violation with pions bended, although I don't recover cover full pion. I don't have as wide pion beam as Dune has, and I thought that was interesting. And other thing which I mean strikes me as a possibility is, if you are bending the pion beams for 2.8 degrees, at one point you can switch experiment and say, okay, I'm not going to bend the beam at all. I'm going to shoot the pion under the angle of 2.8 degrees. And in this case, you get a lot of off-axis particles around the second minimum, which I thought it will be interesting. I understand that people do not want to change Dune design. Okay. But anyway, conclusion was at that time that there is a possibility that same detectors, very expensive detectors, same beamline, very expensive beamline, can be used as on and off experiment. And at that time, because there was no interest, as people say, there are no customers, forget it, I gave up. But in last couple months, maybe Shar came and says that there is very interesting physics that can be done with near detector in the case if there is a restriction of energy of the particles. I have to tell you that when I try to tune beam, my game was to try as wide beam as it possible. I never try really the narrower beam if there is interest for that. But also after Alan's talk, I mean, it occurred to me that although this approach does not have as well defined muon momentum as Newpil or Newstorm, there is a large amount of the flux and large detectors, so probably most of the physics which Newstorm wanted to do can be done this way as that might allow also no need for the spectrometer because the flux can be defined easier. Once again, I'm not really pushing this. I'm just giving this as an example, which, and I'm really inviting community to really start talking much more intensely about possibilities of doing neutrino beam slightly different than for the last 40 years. That's all that I had.
Any comments? Okay, so that's it that we had for talks. There's some time here for general discussion. If there's things people continue to want to discuss, or we can adjourn early and then we'll reconvene for a final session before the retreat on the 26th.
So maybe it's kind of a generic question, but it has to do with the beamline design, and I'm glad Vaya is here. So I guess I assume that there's a lot of, you know, remote handling capability that's built in already that you need for the LBNF beamline so that you can just repair and replace horns anyway, right? So I guess the question is how, you know, how flexible is, you know, do you think that the way things are designed are in such a way that you could only put in exactly the same, you know, a horn with exactly the same outer dimensions, or, you know what I mean? Like, you know, well, or, you know, is the chase flexible enough that you could put, you know, horns? I mean, there have been discussions about, oh, separating the horns, but could you also put in horns with slightly different outer dimensions? You know, there must be some list of constraints that.
Yes. I mean, right now we have three horns, and one of them, the second horn determines the length because it is 4 meter plus, and both the third and second determine the width of the work cell, because especially horn C, but also B have, so the work cell and remote handling facility has requirements about length and width. I mean, it has, there is some room there, but we certainly don't try to make it even bigger, I mean, significantly bigger from what.
So that's the first constraint that you come across is the work cell. Well.
I guess the only other thing is, other than reminding people to send back, fill out the form of specific things they want to hear about next time, or if they want to specifically talk about something. If people have specific things they want to just mention now, they can do that. If not, then I'll let you go and enjoy your Friday afternoons.